I love Salome because also, you know, I worked with those Orthodox monks from, there is a monastery here close to Novi Sad, my hometown. And I became friends with them, sometimes just going for walks and, you know, having really nice conversations in that context that's so different from the rest of the world. And then at some point I asked them to suggest a chant that I can use in the piece with Kronos, Beyond Zero, and Bill Morrison's film. And they said, oh yeah, we will suggest a chant, but why don't you come and we can sing and you record it and then we'll see how it works. So they sang for me and let me use the recording in Beyond Zero. But then they sang other things which were completely unrelated, and I recorded all of that, and they said, oh yeah, if you feel like it can fit somewhere else, you know, use it. So the very opening of Salome is the monks from the monastery chanting one Laudamus Te, which is not even a part of the Orthodox tradition. It is the part of the Western Christian tradition, but they just have a beautiful repertoire of sacred music. So the connection with the monks also can be heard in Salome.
Well, the score is fantastic. I mean, it brings so much to the movie. It's really, yeah, congratulations. I mean, so much of your music is fantastic, but that score particularly.
It's just so nice that you say that. Thank you.
My guest on the program today is composer Alexandra Brebelov, and I had kind of a funny experience with her score for Salome, because I had gone to Film Forum to see Salome. This is the classic 1923 silent film for what I thought was going to be live piano accompaniment. And I get there and somebody from Film Forum comes in and says, hey, everybody, just want to make sure you know that this particular screening of Salome will not have live piano accompaniment. Instead, it has a new score. And I was kind of disappointed, but of course I stuck around, and then I just thought the score was absolutely fantastic. I thought it brought so much to this classic expressionistic film, and it's such a bizarre film in so many ways. If you don't know it, check it out. Salome from 1923. This is the original. Anyway, I ran into Alexandra some months later at a concert of the Bergamot Quartet. They were playing music by her, and I was working with them on a different project, and I thought it would be great to have her on the program. So it's really an honor to be able to talk with her today. Welcome to Relevant Tones. I'm Seth Bosted. Let's jump right back into my conversation with Alexandra Brebelov and feature as much of her music as we can.
It was 95 when I came to San Francisco to study at the conservatory, and I came there to do my master's. And I chose the school because they had, I wanted to leave Serbia. We were in the middle of the wars in the 90s. And I thought the US was the best place to go for grad school. I pretty randomly chose San Francisco and the conservatory because I knew I wanted a smaller school rather than the large university. And when I arrived to San Francisco, I realized that Kronos was from San Francisco. I knew they were from the US, but I never actually located them precisely. And I used to work in the library at the conservatory, and in the Musical America, I found their address and realized that they're basically in the neighborhood, because also the conservatory was at Sunset back then, and their office is also in Sunset. So I was just working on my first string quartet, and I finished the piece and I mailed it to their office. And my thought was just, I didn't even think that they would played. My thought was, I just want them to know that it exists, because they were so huge for me, you know, the idea that they would be interested in doing anything. But I wanted them to see it. And then David Harrington called Left a message on my voice machine, which was totally incredible to find. And he said, "Hey, we got your quartet, and we're now back from a tour, and I had time to listen to it, and it's really great, and we would love to meet you." So that's how it started, and that was already April of '96 when we met. And then he said that they nurture relationships, they develop relationships with composers, and that it's an ongoing long process, that's what they're interested in, and that I should just send any work that I write. It doesn't have to be for strings, that they would just like to know what I'm doing and what occupies me as a composer and a growing artist. And for a while I did, and then I wrote one piece for them because just the impression of meeting them was so strong. I wrote a piece that's not commissioned, that was my second string quartet in 97, which they premiered at the Vienna Staatsoper the summer after that. And then a year later, they commissioned the very first work for me, which was Pannonia Boundless.
Wow, that's amazing. That's really fantastic. Can you talk to me about the My Desert, My Rose and the 50 for the Future project?
50 for the Future project for me is probably one of the most significant personally projects that I was a part of. And the musical side of it, of course, is spectacular. It's Kronos, and it's the best, most powerful presenters in the world making it happen. But on the other side, and this is the one that's especially important to me, on the other side, you have young composers and young groups all over the world who have access to that music completely free of charge in a legal way, which is really important if you think from a point of view that's not the Western world. In the 90s, when I was going to school, and late 80s in Yugoslavia, when the country was falling apart, we didn't have access to a lot of literature, and especially the newest, most contemporary work that was being created at the time. So very often, to be able to participate and to share in the world of ideas, we would have to Xerox, you know, make copies of things that were not, we couldn't buy them. And if they were available to buy them, we didn't have the money to do it, which is the case for many places in the world at the moment too. Even if people have access to online ordering of things, they don't have the means to afford that. And coming from that place where you really feel you are not equal in terms of participation, this project felt so right that we would just make every young musician on this planet feel that they belong to this world, that they belong to that cutting edge place of ideas and new things happening. So that was the starting point. And I was in the very first group of composers who were asked to write the works in year one. And also I thought, since the nature of that music is to also be instructive in some way, to bring the quartet playing to the next level, because they're educational pieces. My thinking was, okay, I'm trying to now do something new also with Kronos, because if we learn through the process, somebody else will learn through the process for sure. So the piece, the way I structured it, starts as a very open first third of the piece segment, with the score that's loosely written only in patterns. And there are no markings of time. There are no bar lines, and there is no coordination in the score for musicians other than the instruction to listen to each other and cue at certain points. But how they would arrive to those points, it's not defined, which meant that the extreme acute listening is necessary, and that they would, rather than be very precise in following their own part and, you know, rehearse their own part and delivering that, they would really have to be super aware of what goes on around them and then make choices based on the environment, the sound environment, which also results that in that the piece is always different. Every time it's performed, the first third, even the first half is always different. And then towards the end, the piece locks in and it becomes a very precise metric thing that's also complex. But what we learned is that high metric complexity at the end is much easier to put together than the open, free, loosely written beginning. So the hope was that every young group that would start to put it together, that their bonding as a group and understanding how the next person to your left or right is thinking and hearing the sound would become very important.
Thank you.
Let's just back up a little bit. Talk to me about, you mentioned it, but you know, it was a very difficult time for Yugoslavia when you were young, when you were a student. I mean, how are you balancing your musical studies? It's hard enough to go to music school when conditions are, you know, I went to music school in Missouri and everything was fine, you know. Our biggest problem was, where are we going to get a beer tonight, you know, after the concert? But you had very different situation. I mean, how are you balancing the political situation, all the terrible things that are happening, with also this need to do your studies and you know, become a proficient composer?
Well, I think the balancing is actually what happens more naturally in a situation like that. Because on one side, you have the lowest of civilization, which is conflict, aggression, war, national hatred, what, you know, everything that comes with that. You see greed, you see people really becoming the very little of humanness is in situations like that. And then on the other side, you have music, which also means not only music making, what we would do together, but also the music making historically with the greatest literature and the greatest beauty that our civilization knows. So you know always that other side exists. And I think the balancing really happens naturally, because you have two options: either to look at the reality that's really awful, or to choose that other reality that also exists and is available, and in a way has open arms for you. You can just dive into the sound and either playing or listening to music or writing it. And immediately it becomes something that's really healing and really makes sense. So very early on for me, that awareness of music as being so much more than a piece of art, so much more. It's really a whole other world that's available for as a refuge.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it just becomes so much more poignant when you're, you know, I mean, for me, the things you're talking about, the lowest part of human civilization, the aggression, the violence, all of that is mostly academic for me. But for you, it was very real, you know. So, I mean, it's impressive to me that you can take all of that in and still have this very optimistic attitude and you know, still believe in the power and the joy of making music.
Well, I think it, as I said, it happens naturally, because when you experience, for example, the air raids, you don't have too much choice. You can either succumb to fear, or you can have that strong belief that will also pass, and that the only way to survive in the healthiest way possible is to realize that there are builders in life and there are destroyers in life. And I think we see it daily. We see it in even in our at peaceful times. You see that there are people who tend to destroy and make things worse, and there are people who build and make things better. And those two groups in a situation that's extreme as that, those two groups become very obvious. And then in a way I felt like, okay, this is my time to make that choice. I'm not a destroyer, I'm a builder. In my world, building means creating music, being kind to people, understanding that I belong to some, it happened to me that I'm a part of some larger scheme of things where I don't live in a place that's peaceful. I happen to be in a place where there is unrest and violence and suffering happening. And at the same time as the bombing of Serbia was happening in 1999, I had incredible friends in the US. I already had my San Francisco experience in 95 and 96. I already knew Kronos Quartet. I was in touch with David, as he mentioned in that interview. We were in touch during the bombing. So I knew that the generalization that led to the bombing of the country where I was then in Serbia, that generalization also is not good, because I have incredible friends who are also making music and making beauty and believing in peace, and all of us having a decent human peaceful life, or at least the possibility to live that way. And then there are those who have different agendas. So in a way, I'm glad I experienced it, because this is one of those things. You are glad you lived through it, and you don't want ever again for it to happen to you or to anybody else. But the experience is just immense and can make one a better person.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Talk to me about the piece, The Danube Etude.
The Danube Etude I wrote pretty recently for the pianist who is from my hometown, Novi Sad. She was one of the earliest performers of minimalism. She was the earliest proponent of American composers and minimalists. And there was an idea to do a piece that's dedicated to her and to my hometown, which was sponsored by the city of Novi Sad and several other organizations here. But it was very inspiring, because like in many other works where I felt happiest when I create, it's when there is a personal emotional connection, either to the subject matter or to the performers. And in this case, both things came together. So I wrote a piece that is minimal. At least there is the minimal movement in left hand. And that was as an homage to her. Branka Parlić is the name of the pianist. And the celebration of the city is through the Danube element, because Danube is the river that runs through the city. I didn't write a lot of piano music, because I just the keys and the color, that's I just find other instruments to have more options in extending and expanding the sound. So usually when I do things for piano, I at least partially prepare the keyboard, so that I have the true, to say so, the true piano sound, and then that there are also interventions with color and texture. So in this case of the Danube Etude, I prepared it with ping pong balls. So every time she would hit the key, they would bounce and create other new little sounds. And also with metal small chains like necklaces, so that we have another resonance that's a little more controlled, doesn't bounce all over the place, but still changes the color. And I distributed preparation through different regions of the piano, so that, for example, she has the minimal accompaniment in the left hand. This is one color, and then registers around it are different. So there is a sense of multi-dimensional texture almost, that would just on one keyboard bring us to different worlds depending in what register we are.
Can you talk about Constellation Hartig?
Constellation Hartig was the first piece I wrote after my father died a few years ago. And it was a big thing to do because I also wrote it for a violinist friend who grew up with me in Serbia, and I left for the US, and at the same time she left for the Netherlands and built a career there. And she wanted to, she did a project with a set of pieces that were all written for her. And it, again, it was very personal on several levels. So I was thrilled to deal with the idea of past and memories because of my relationship with her, also because of my the loss of my father. And what I discovered is that in that space, when you lose a parent or anyone who is so close, all the sounds that were coming to me, most of all, were just colors, very abstract segments that sounded like fragments, but they were not even fragments of melodies. They were really fragments of textures and colors. And it was a little uncomfortable to admit that I'm moving in a world that's so not defined, because for me, the structure, the craft of working on a piece, that I feel that that's my forte, and I have a really clear idea of structures and form, and I really love to build a structure. But here I discovered that almost some new part of me was being revealed, where I didn't really have to go into the architectural side of the piece, but just to collect those abstract segments, those textural things, and put them in an order that is dramatically satisfying. The piece was already played many times, and I'm still discovering things in it. And that piece, in a way, stands out because it's probably one of those pieces, and I'm sure you know that as a composer, there are pieces that surprise us, and you don't know how you came to a specific solution or how it is even possible that that sound and that combination of sounds happened. So that piece I really consider to be one of those moments when moments of realization that creativity and the deepest connection with that process sometimes isn't through the masterful crafting of things, but through actually really letting go on one hand and deeply being connected to what really goes on inside. Thank you.
Thank you.
a lot of times everybody hides behind craft, or they hide behind pitch sets and things, and they don't talk about emotionality. And so it's really refreshing to talk to somebody who's, you know, music to me is so emotional. It's such an emotional medium, and it can contain so many emotions at once. That's what was really drew me to it, that music can be happy and sad at the same time. And, you know, so for you to talk about this stuff as a composer is really refreshing for me.
Thank you. I love it too.
Let's talk about Epilogue.
Epilogue is a part of my very first opera, Mileva, which I wrote for the Serbian National Theater. And having that long, beautiful relationship with Kronos Quartet, at some point, that was almost 15 years ago, I told them, hey guys, you know, I can't do a quartet now because I'm working on an opera and it's huge. And then David Harrington said, he was very disappointed in me. He said, you're really going to write an opera? Just imagine how many smaller pieces can be, how many quartets can be written for the time investment and energy for that one, like old fashioned piece almost. I mean, he was also joking and I took it as a joke. But then I realized, yeah, I shouldn't really go for 2 years without, you know, working with them, and they were ready for a new piece. So the very last section of the opera is the epilogue, and I wrote it first as a string quartet score with one voice, which in the recording that we have is Judith Bergson. She is a mezzo-soprano and a cantor and a composer herself, so it was beautiful to work with her. And the piece is on Goethe's poetry, on his the Orfisch. The Orfisch is called the poem, and this is the section where he talks about the destiny. The opera itself is about Mileva Einstein's first wife and their very unhappy marriage. And I thought that both of them loved Goethe, by the way. So the destiny as the choice for the text somehow was obvious, and I thought fit very well for the ending of the opera.
Thank you.
That's Epilogue from the opera Mileva by composer Alexandra Brebilov. And that is all the time we have on the program today. Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit organization with the mission of bringing musical creativity to life every day. Find out more at acmusic.org. For Relevant Tones, I'm Seth Bosted. Thanks so much for listening.